Hi and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week on the podcast, our guest is Jeremy Cooper, Chairman of Retirement Income at Challenger. Jeremy was the chair of the government's Super Systems Review, often called the Cooper Review, nearly 10 years ago. And prior to that, he was the Deputy Chairman at ASIC. In a departure from our usual format, we'll be discussing retirement this week. Whether you're just starting your career or approaching your retirement age or anywhere in between, this is a topic that affects every Australian. We'll discuss what worked and what didn't from the Cooper Review, why super funds need to be more like banks, and some of the hidden risks of investing in retirement. Finally, if you're loving the rules of investing, why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's good to finally have you on.
Thanks, Patrick. Good to be here.
If you don't mind, I'm actually going to start a little bit differently to how I usually do with a personal anecdote. If we go back, I think we'd be talking about 8 years now, maybe seven. I was working in superannuation actually, and I was just getting into investing myself. And part of our CPD or continuing professional development that year was reviewing your report, the Cooper Review.
Right.
And at the same time, I was just starting to get interested in some stocks and doing some research. And I saw that you had just been announced as being the new chairman of Retirement Income at Challenger. So that was actually my first exposure to Challenger and, you know, sparked up a bit of an interest in the stock. So it's interesting, you know, it's 7 or 8 years later, I can't remember exactly, to now be sitting down and chatting with you.
It's pretty much 8 years actually. And if you bought the stock in those days, you'd be doing fairly well now.
Yeah. It's come a long way in that time. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your background for those people who maybe not as familiar with you. I know you started your career out as a lawyer, so could you give us a bit of a guide for how you went from being a lawyer through to the chairman of the Super Systems Review?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, I guess I finished school in the 1970s, which seems a very long time ago, and I actually, before gap years were even a thing, I decided to take 3 years off before I went to university, and over that time I did some interesting things. I worked on an offshore oil rig and travelled around Australia and so on, and then by that time I was really quite focused. I wanted to go and study law, which I did, and I then joined a large firm, and I was doing what was sort of vogue at the time, I suppose, mergers and acquisitions and takeovers and corporate advice, and I sort of did that for 20 years actually, and I had a great time, and I think, unlike today where I think law roles are very specialised, I was able to do a pretty broad range of I got to look at a lot of different businesses and give all sorts of different advice. But after 20 years of it, frankly, I got sick of it, and I thought to myself, well, if I don't jump off this boat, I'll end up getting into my mid-50s, and then, like law firms do, they sort of move people on to make room for the younger lawyers, and I didn't really want to be in that situation, so I took an active step. I said to the firm, look, I want to go and explore other roles, and to cut a long story short, at that time there was a vacancy as the deputy chairman of ASIC, the corporate regulator, and I ended up sitting in Peter Costello's office doing an interview and got the job. And that was in 2004. So I did that role for 5 years and got exposed to, particularly, I suppose, coming from the corporate side, I went into ASIC and realised that the corporate side of things looked after itself reasonably well, and most of the really important issues were in the area of retail investors and ordinary people interacting with the financial services markets and capital markets and various scams and all of the things that are on a regulator's plate. So I spent a lot of time doing that kind of stuff, and then when my term ended, it's a 5-year role, the then government asked me to chair a review of the super system, and it was quite clever in the sense that I wasn't an identity in the super system. I didn't come from any of the tribes that you have in super, but I did have I had a pretty open mind, and I had a lot of knowledge about how the industry worked, and in particularly how individual Australians interact and what outcomes they get out of a system like that. So that's the sort of twisty road of how I got to do that job.
Well, I guess that leads us naturally to the next point, which is the what we usually call the Cooper Review, technically the Super Systems Review. It's been nearly 10 years now since, well, at least since it started. I think it was it June 2009 that you got started on that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it would have been, you know, I think it was about a year later that you handed in the report.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm curious, what worked and what do you think didn't work?
Well, I think, use the feedback I get from people, the sort of standout was really the, and it was a very obvious reform to do, but the bundle of improvements in the back office that I captioned as Superstream, which really took the industry from a paper-based shambles, frankly, a real kind of 20th century situation, and it took it into the 21st century. And indeed, some people tell me that the new payments platform that's currently being rolled out is sort of largely based on the ideas of Superstream. So that was, in a sense, I used that as it was a bankable enough project. So if the Super System Review hadn't achieved anything else and just delivered Superstream, it would have washed its face. So we were very keen to get that program done, and then working on the more difficult projects that we worked on. I think it's fair to say that my super has been a success. So there's something like $675 billion in the default My Super sector of the system. You could argue that prices and the cost of My Super and the transparency of it hasn't worked as quickly as you might have liked. On the other hand, there was a fairly long delay in actually getting the thing fully up and running. It's only really been up and running in full form for a couple of years. So I'd have to treat that as a success with more to do. A lot of the nuances, a lot of the transparency and measurement and outcomes recommendations really weren't fully taken up. And they're now at least partly the subject of some of the bills that are in Parliament at the moment. At the moment, the stuff that APRA has been asking for, you can actually trace some of those ideas back to the review. And then the really hard bit, the governance improvements have been a struggle because of two reasons. One, they're personal. In other words, they involve making judgments about human beings, and that's always a bit testy, and they're highly politicised. So when I finished the chapter on governance, I thought, well, this is going to be a 10-year project, so we've still got a little bit of time to go.
It certainly seems like governance has become a big issue in the last few years, so I guess we might still see that play out in the not too distant future.
Look, I agree. I think pretty well as we're seeing in the Royal Commission at the moment, pretty well all problems in industries like financial services relate back to governance, one way or another. You can trace problems to governance. So I think you're right. It's just a question of how it comes back on the agenda and whether it can be perhaps more inclusive and more consensual than the debate has tended to have developed into a bit of a war. But I certainly do think that it does need to be looked at again.
Well, let's talk about the Royal Commission. It is the topic of the moment. Of course, we're having the final hearings now with the very senior executives at the banks. Certainly there's been some pretty amazing revelations throughout the whole process. Did they surprise you, some of the stuff that came out, or is this kind of what you would have expected based on your experience?
Look, yes and no. So as a former regulator, I suppose I was fairly accustomed to a steady stream of corporate misbehaviour and non-compliance and other odd things that happen. But I was surprised at the seemingly widespread, sort of, if I can put it bluntly, spinning and lying to the regulator that was going on in some of these large shops. That was odd. Don't forget, of course, it is a Royal Commission about misconduct, so it's only focusing on the bad end. But nonetheless, they haven't been wanting for content, that's for sure. So I was certainly surprised about that. It's almost as if the regulators were being taken as being a bit of a joke that you could toy with and give sort of selectively provide them with information and just kind of brush them off. So something has gone seriously wrong there. And again, I suppose coming back to my views about governance, it seemed to me that lack of leadership was one of the primary problems in these organisations. And secondly, a fair amount of incompetence, to be quite honest. So a lot of the witnesses that were appearing just didn't seem to have, for one reason or another, a proper handle on what they should and shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah, I watched a number of the hearings myself, and I completely agree with you on that one. But look, let's take a bit of a change of subject. I wanted to talk about risks. Mm-hmm. Now, there's 100 different risks that you can take on or choose not to take on, but there's one that comes up a lot in retirement, which I think is not discussed very often. Mm-hmm. And when it is, it's often misunderstood. But I think it is really important for current and future retirees to understand. So could you explain to us, first of all, what is sequencing risk?
Okay, well, we could probably spend an hour talking about this, but it is an important risk to understand, and it particularly relates to retirees. So it's basically, it's a form of market risk. So it's evident in portfolios that have volatility, but it's amplified by cash flows. So if you think about superannuation, it is actually, by dint of the way it's designed, from the very first participation in super, you're actually making cash flows. And what I mean by that is you're contributing into a volatile mix of assets. So sequencing risk in theory actually sort of starts right from the beginning, but it's most harmful to retirees either leading up to retirement or in the early phases of retirement. Now I'll explain why. So there are really sort of three physical properties that you need to understand to get sequencing risk. The first is that a super balance starts small and ends up being the largest just at the point before retirement. So losses at the large end are really significant. Losses at the small end are actually more or less irrelevant. And indeed, when you've spent down your savings, let's say you're in your 90s and you've got limited capital left, losses at that end are relatively insignificant as well. So you've got this hump effect that technicians call portfolio size effect. So when you've got a big portfolio, you're most exposed to a sort of a percentage decline. Let's get into these cash flows. So it's inwards during accumulation and outwards during the drawdown phase. What this means is that the dollars are buying and selling, but particularly in the drawdown phase, you're actually selling units of capital at different prices. So as the prices go up and down, if you're having to draw out a specific amount of money to live on, which is what retirement's actually about, so let's say that you draw out $2,000 a month over the course of your retirement to spend on power bills and food and all that kind of thing. If the units of capital are going up and down in your superannuation account, as they are in an account-based pension, you are actually selling units at good times and at bad times. Now, if you're in the position of not having to consume or draw down on that capital, if you can actually sit out of the market, well then sequencing risk ceases to apply to you. So if you have a portfolio with absolutely no cash flows in or out of it, it doesn't matter what the sequences of returns can be. They can be negative at the start, they can be big in the middle. it actually ends up with exactly the same. You can build a little model to demonstrate this. But the minute you start either contributing, and we can ignore that side of it because we're really talking about retirement here, the minute you start drawing out of it, the volatility, it's the volatility is driving it, and it's all about this seesawing of actually disposing of units of capital at different prices. Now, if you get a bad run, in other words, early on in retirement, if you're making these regular, let's go back to my example of the $2,000 a month spending, if you get a bad run of returns early in retirement, it can actually affect the whole of your retirement. And it goes a little bit like this. Let's say you've got $1 million in your self-managed fund. In year one, the market goes down by 10%. So the value of your self-managed fund is now $900,000. In year two, we're not doing any cash flows at the moment. Then in year two, the market goes up 10%. Now, the fact is you're actually not square. You haven't gone back to your million, you've gone back to $990,000. Now, let's move into the world where you're actually making those cash flows. You're actually spending the $2,000 of the month right from the beginning. So as the market goes down, you're actually depleting capital further. It tries to claw its way back with a 10% increase, but of course, because of spending, it's actually gone down below $900,000, and the drain of the spending makes it just so much more difficult for you to get back square. So as the name sequencing implies, investment returns are actually path dependent. You know, they come from somewhere and they end up somewhere. And even though you might have a retirement where you and I might have exactly the same average returns, if you look into the sequence, I might have a really much worse retirement because I just haven't got those returns in the right order. So yeah, that was a long-winded explanation, but there's a fair bit in it.
Yeah, no, that made perfect sense, and so I'm sure that it would be very useful to people. I might even try and lay out some of those numbers you've just mentioned in writing for people if they want to go and have a look in the wire to the podcast. I always find when I'm adding things up and subtracting things, it's easier to look at them on paper.
we've done quite a detailed research paper on all this, which I could give you a link to if that would help listeners.
Perfect. Yeah. I'll definitely include a link to that. That'd be good. I'll get it off you after today. But let's talk about a different type of risk. I actually spoke to a gentleman earlier this year who is kind of a specialist in investing in longevity technologies, and we did a whole podcast all about the scientific and, you know, the medical breakthroughs that are happening right now that could greatly extend human lifespans over the next generation or two. So obviously the current system is set up for people based on current life expectancies. So how can you mitigate those risks that we may live a lot longer than we expected? Obviously, your money's going to run out under the current system. Is there a way to deal with this, and can you explain it a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, it's really interesting. Paul Keating has from time to time reflected that the superannuation system that he was thinking of in the late 80s and 90s was a world where people were actually seeking to retire earlier than they do these days. So people were sort of aiming to retire around 55, and they would have a 20-year, you know, they would on average die, say, at 75. In the space of 20 years, it's just extraordinary how life expectancies have increased, the speed with which they've increased. So in those times, so in the 90s, the mode, if you look at any particular year in the 90s and you look back 1 year and you just look at when did people die in that year? So this isn't a projection, this is actually going backwards. The most common age that males and females were dying in the 90s was age 78. If you wind that forward to I think the first year this happened was about 2014. You're sitting in 2015, you look at, okay, who died in 2014 and when? That age had actually clocked up to 87. The peak of the histogram, so the most common age of death, is 87. Now, globally, there's some indication that while Life expectancies are still increasing. In the UK and Europe, there's some evidence, it's not that strong, but there's some evidence that the pace of increase is slowing a bit. So it's still increasing, but it's not increasing as at the same pace. We don't quite know why that's happening. So we've got a system where we've stretched the amount of time people are living quite dramatically, and while the system's still actually been maturing. So the solution to the way to deal with longevity risk, which is simply the risk of outliving your savings by dint of being a person who lives longer than average. We call that idiosyncratic risk. So that is the risk that you get a group of 165-year-olds, you're going to get a distribution of how long those people live. Some people will live on the short side, you'll get a lot at the average, and then you'll get outliers that live in one standard deviation of lives actually sees people within that standard deviation actually living up to 8 years longer than the average. So that's two-thirds of people are going to be in that distribution. And the thing about it is we don't know who is going to be which. We can sort of take guesses, but you do not know how long you're going to live. So what annuities do is that they pool that risk in. And what effectively happens is you get the people who live a short time subsidise the people who end up living longer than average. And the way that works, it's called mortality credits. So your unconsumed capital then gets spread across the pool. And by doing that, you can actually diversify away the idiosyncratic risk. Then you look at you do pooling, that yields mortality credits, that spreads out the risk. You then have the life company that issues the annuities and is matching the liabilities to continue making payments to survivors. It finds assets that have a similar duration and cash flow to match that risk. The life company's prudentially supervised. And then I guess one of the secret sources to all of this is that the remaining risk is buffered by shareholder capital. And so that is in a nutshell how the annuity deals with longevity risk.
It's quite a succinct explanation for what is actually a pretty complex topic,
Yes, there's a bit in us, yes. And it's not well understood in this country because it's not common. If you go to the UK, the concept of annuitisation is embedded in everybody understands what it is. But in Australia, it's not well understood.
Yeah, well, actually, I might take that opportunity to skip forward a little bit. There's a bit of a perception. You might have a different view as to whether it's actually something that happens in reality a lot, but there's certainly a perception in Australia that a lot of people, they hit retirement, they get their super as a lump sum, they go and renovate their house or go on overseas holidays, buy new cars, and then end up, blowing all their money in the first few years and then going on an aged pension. Do you think there's anything that can be done to mitigate that problem? And if so, how do you think we should approach it?
Okay, well, I think certainly in theory, because we don't have any restrictions around what you can do with your super, there is absolutely the potential to, on your first day of retirement, you could ask your super fund to give you a lump sum of everything you've got, and you could go off and do whatever you like with it. And that, at least in theory, has always been a risk. And I think in the early days of superannuation, when people were retiring with pretty small balances, it was, they would take it out of the super fund and maybe put it in the bank and, not really do much with it. We're in a very different world now where we've just done some work looking at households in the 60 to 64 age group. So it's just, that's the data you get, and it's a pretty good proxy for people who are just about to go in retirement. And we reckon that the average Australian household in that group has got over 500,000 in super, and the median's got around 400,000. Now, you can't go out and buy a shopping centre with that money, but it is actually a pretty decent, you can actually do quite a lot with that in terms of, smoothing out consumption and having a decent standard of living in retirement. So we're in a slightly different world at the moment, where the data that that we see out there and the research that's happening is showing that retirees are actually kind of well aware of increasing life expectancies and the fact that we're in a in an environment where self-provision is the order of the day. And there are not a lot of people who aspire to living solely on the age pension. And so what they're doing is actually they're underspending and they're being too frugal. And they're doing this because in our system at the moment, we're effectively asking them to self-insure. So they have to take, they are exposed to all the risks that we've been talking about, particularly outspending their relatively limited savings. They're exposed to longevity risk and uncertainties and market. You know, right now the retirees will be worried about what the market's doing. They get all this. And they're in a sense being their own little life insurance. They've got their capital, and they're buffering the risk by hanging on to that capital. And that's actually not what you want. A retirement income system, particularly one where you've deferred your wages, you know, there's money you haven't spent over your working life, you put it into this thing called superannuation. What the system should provide people with is the ability to safely and sensibly spend that down over you know, sustainably over the decades that they're in retirement. They get a better standard of living, and so long as they can do that with the risks being properly managed, that is a better, for most people, that's a better outcome than we're currently doing.
There seems to be a perception that amongst the retirees themselves that they should be trying to have capital left over at the end of their lives to bequeath to a family member or whatever.
But yeah.
You know, as you've said, it's really not the purpose of the system.
No.
And you want, you know, it's not necessarily good for the economy at a macro scale to have people acting in that way.
Yeah, it's not surprising though, because it's sort of human nature in a sense. You get told for, not that anyone's been in super for 40 years, but the idea is you sort of have roughly 40 years working and you're being, I guess, in a compulsory system, there's a very strong normative message going on that it's good to save up. You know, it's save your money. Don't waste it. And then you get to retirement, and you're actually saying, well, you forget all that. Now you've got to actually spend it now. So there is, in the research we do, people still have there are two sort of assets that they have different bequest motives. There's the family home. And so what a lot of retirees do is that they're prepared to spend down their financial resources, but they want to pass the family home on. And then there's another set of attitudes around the actual money side of it, their financial resources. We find that people are less focused on leaving. They're still quite keen to leave the home because it's kind of convenient, but they are kind of less. A lot of retirees think, well, if I actually do end up spending down all of my retirement savings, you know, improving our standard of living, well, that's what it's for. But in terms of their actual behaviour, they still seem to be. The Treasury have a number that around about the average retiree dies with about one third of their super unspent.
That's much higher than I would have expected,
yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah, well, it's a you know, rule of thumb, yeah. type number, and they're sort of saying, well, two things are of issue to the policymakers, I guess. One is the sort of tax concessions that have been given to put that money in there in the first place. And then the reality that, well, I suppose also secondly, the fact that the rump, the unspent money then can be passed on to the next generation at either no tax or a maximum of 17% without getting into the fine detail of taxed and untaxed. And then, of course, you know, they've just had a lower standard of living. By not spending that money, they've had a lower standard of living than they might have otherwise been able to.
Which, of course, means lower consumer spending.
Lower spending, that's right.
Yeah, which means money retailers.
Up. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Flow on effects through the economy
yep.
can be quite significant. Yeah.
Yep.
Look, you spoke a little bit about Paul Keating before, who is, of course, the mastermind behind the original superannuation system. And I think award, as well as the superannuation guarantee, if I recall correctly. And he said in interviews that the age pension is always is intended to be for lower income, less wealthy people. The very wealthy people, they don't really need a lot of help in retirement.
Yep.
The superannuation system was set up to benefit middle income earners.
Yeah, the mass average, middle.
Yeah, yep, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Do you actually think the current system as it stands, is fit for people in retirement, and why or why not?
Well, I think I'd answer that question this way. I think it's the numbers I gave you earlier of the amounts that average and median households have got shows you that the building up phase is working. You know, I think a lot of people still think the system's immature and that people are retiring with low balances. Well, they are genuine numbers that demonstrate, and no surprise, the thing's been going for more than 25 years. So the money's there. I guess the issue that I have is this one about the safe consumption of the money, you know, lowering the amount of risk that's going on in retirement and actually allowing you to safely consume that. That's the challenge at the moment. The government's aware of it. It's working on a program called the Retirement Income Framework, which has got two pieces. One is a governance. So interestingly enough, in the key superannuation legislation, the Superannuation Industry Supervision Act, there is actually no guidance on doing that. There's no covenant in the Act that actually tells trustees how to provide retirement income in retirement. That seems extraordinary. Everyone I put that to goes, that seems like a bit of an omission. Let's do something about that. So the government is pursuing that, and then it's working on, it is clarified, and these will be legislated by the 1st of July next year, some new rules about how the age pension means tests treat pooled longevity lifetime income products like the ones I've described. So that job's been done. And then they're working on more product-oriented rules around a thing called a comprehensive income product for retirement, which would be pretty much what we've got now, the account-based pension with some either deferred or immediate lifetime income via a pooled product of one sort or another. So there's stuff on, and that's the work that remains to be done. But certainly in terms of adequacy and the balances that are being built up, there's a little bit of a debate going on at the moment as to whether the super guarantee rate should be at 9.5% or 12%. I regard that as a bit of a political decision, largely because of the compulsion aspect. So you can sit here and actuarially calculate what 12% would look like in retirement and what 9% would look like, or some figure in between that. But the fact is, that's not an arid academic question. When you look at the system, you are actually taking money out of people's hands and deferring it for the future. Now, there are some people, and of course the point is that you don't have individual SG rates. It's just one rate. It's very much a one size fits all. There are some people for whom, you know, they've got so much wealth that these numbers are more or less irrelevant. You've got a big mass in the middle where they may well be better off going up to 12%, and that's why the decision has been made to go up to 12. But then you've got people on lower incomes where taking a bite out of their weekly pay packet, so moving up from the 9.5%, you know, actually impacts them adversely. They may be better off, given that a lot of those people will be relying more on the age pension. They may be actually better off to have that money day to day or week to week. So it does become quite tricky to pinpoint, because you've got everybody in as a totally one size fits all arrangement. At the margins, you can find people that are disadvantaged.
Well, that concludes the main part of the interview, but I've got a couple of favourite questions that I like to go over with each one of my guests. So if you're open to that, we can jump into those questions.
Sure.
Now. Cool. All right. So the first one is, could you share something that you've read recently? It could be a book, but an article, a piece of research that really impressed you, that you thought was really, really interesting.
I suppose I do try to, I mean, in a job like this, you do a lot of reading, but I try and read fiction as often as I can. And I've become very keen on a Japanese author, Haruki Murakami. Now that sounds incredibly exotic, but of course, not only are they in English, but they're very accessible. They're very Western, although they're very Japanese, they're also very Western. So Murakami, I just think it really speaks to me. He's written quite a lot of books, but one in particular that I read during the year, a pretty large book, Kafka on the Shore, about a teenage boy who sort of runs away from a difficult home and it's just got everything in it. You know, it's got cats that talk, so a lot of magic realism, a lot of mystery, and a bit of humour, and then it spent a lot of time on just basic aspects of human life, just like eating meals, and it's just got it all, and lots of unsolved, lots of things that you just there just aren't an answer as to what, you know, what it describes certain events that happen, and you just have to work out for yourself what it all means. So, I have very much enjoyed Murakami. I could recommend. He's got some much smaller books that you could start with, but I certainly recommend Murakami to people.
Excellent. I'll find a link for that and put it up in the wire for the
podcast.
Oh, okay.
Excellent. Yeah, that's great.
Alrighty. So if you could go back in time,
yep,
to when you were finishing school or university,
yep,
and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
You know, I think I bought my grandmother actually sort of got me into the share market. She lived on a farm with her husband and children, and she at lunchtime during the week at 1 p.m. there was the ABC news came on, and the news would open with the stock report. They would read out what the mining industrial stocks were doing, and it was kind of, you know, Aberfoyle, BHP, you know, you go through the resource stocks, and we had to be absolutely silent during this process because my gran was a bit of a keen equities investor, and so I bought my first shares in 1981. And just reflecting, I don't know that I've learnt, you know, even though I spent a massive amount of time, and you know, I work in an organisation where, you know, we are just kind of always thinking about markets and so on. Sometimes I challenge myself and think, you know, have I learned anything over that period? I don't say that lightly. So I suppose one of my not catching the falling knife, I guess, is one of them. And I've just done an absolute classic of that. So I'm one of the idiots who, in my self-managed super fund, thought it was a good idea to buy General Electric at about $15. They're currently in the sevens. So that is a falling knife, to be sure. So I suppose it's, so really, I guess, looking back over a long period, it seems to me that you make a lot of your money out of just market beta, and that diversification is absolutely a free lunch, as they say. And yeah, so not losing capital is a big part of it. And I think also as an Australian investor, currency is such an important bit of the equation. But yeah, look, it is challenging because we're human beings. You know, sometimes we you know, notwithstanding all of the counsel to the contrary, we go with our, or in Kahneman's language, we use system one more than we should be using system two. So yeah, there are my thoughts. No great pearls of wisdom, I'm afraid.
Yes, yeah, I think we're all guilty of relying a little bit too much on heuristics at times. I know I certainly am, so you're not alone there. It's funny, there's been such an increase in the awareness of behavioural finance in recent years, and even, you know, reading about these biases and being aware of them, it still doesn't prevent you from falling victim to them.
No, you've just put my point, you just put it more articulately than I, you're quite right. I mean, it's not as if I haven't read all that. In fact, we in our research, we look at a lot of those behavioural economists in trying to understand, you know, we're sitting here trying to investigate and help people in retirement. So we look at all the biases that people have. They, you know, overestimate the value of a lump sum as compared to an actuarially fair income and all sorts of things. So it's not as if I'm a stranger to any of those things.
Well, look, normally I ask people for a stock pick here.
Well, after my GE story, you wouldn't do that to me, would you?
But I always, for my guests who are not stock pickers, not fund managers, I like to try and ask them something that's a little bit relevant to their area of expertise. So given that, if you could change only one thing about our super and retirement system as it stands today, what would it be and why?
Okay, well, about 5 years ago now, I did a much less well-known review for the government, and it was around an idea that I could loosely call a super council. So it was an idea of being creating a very small but potentially important part of the institutional framework, which was basically a policy filtration piece that you could call just the superannuation council, and you would appoint a bunch of suitably qualified and unconflicted people to that body, and its job would be to filter policies for changing superannuation through a set of four principles that were really built around, okay, what's this system for? And then you would, once you'd worked out what those principles were, and there's certainly room for debate about what that would look like, but you can get a reasonable picture around that. Then a proposal comes up, for example, to change the way it's taxed, or to pretty well do anything that affects superannuation. The policy proposal would then be put through this council, and the council would report on whether it thought the proposal actually was sort of within the principles or without, and then that would be tabled in Parliament. Government of the day could ignore that, but over time, if this body gained respect, and it's not dissimilar to the way if you go back to the very foundation of the RBA when it was sitting inside the Commonwealth Bank initially, it was a very small, part of the overall economic system, and over time it's grown into a major independent, piece in the system. Now, superannuation being already a $2.7 trillion system, it's not completely crazy to think that, it needs a little bit of a sort of institutional. It's an attempt to depoliticise and stabilise the sort of policy making around super. And I don't imagine. I mean, I did this work back in 2013. It didn't really get a lot of play. And I don't regularly advocate for it. But you asked me the question. If there was one thing, I've already talked about extensively about the changes I think need to be done in the retirement phase, and the government is already working on that. So you asked me the question, and that's my answer.
Yeah, well, look, certainly as somebody who's previously worked in the superannuation industry, and my partner still does actually, I'm sure for people who are involved in that industry, it would be a massive relief if the whole industry was not so much treated like the political football that it sometimes is today.
Don't get me wrong, I think there does have to be change in terms of policy, and the reason for that is that we keep, in a sense, asking the system to do different things. And we do that because, as I've talked about, life expectancies change. It could well be that the dependency ratio, in other words, the ratio of people who aren't working as opposed to the people who are working, moves around. Fiscal things move. You've got as the savings pool grows, the amount of tax concessions it sucks in increases. So there's a lot of, this is why the intergenerational report, focuses so much on this. A lot of stuff shifts around. So that, don't get me wrong, I'm a big, you hear politicians from time to time, oh, we're going to have no changes for 5 years. Well, I don't think that necessarily works, but it's really the manner in which changes occur, and particularly changes that sort of appear on budget night, I think, tend to erode people's confidence in participating in the system.
Well, look, Jeremy, thanks so much for talking to us today. It's been great to get your very unique insights into our superannuation and retirement system, and I hope you enjoyed the chat.
I did indeed, Patrick. Thank you.